Welcome everybody. I hope you can see and hear me. This is the sixth lecture in my course on the Arahant and the Four Truths in early Buddhist discourse. And today we're going to get into the Four Truths also. Yeah, I start again with some of the things that have been said on the blog. It's just a small remark on the issue of time. Can you hear me?
Yeah. Like
this. This has been taken up by Hedwig Krenn and Soda Ardavas. And I just wanted to clarify what I was trying to say last time. I said that time is our conceptualization of the fact of change. So the change exists independent of our thinking or conceptualization. Time is just the way how we conceptualize this change and how we deal with it and how we portion it up into parts so that, 2:15, Central European summertime, Thursdays, old Anario is going to give us his ideas again and similar things. But whether we think about it or not, change exists. There's no question about that. So it's not a product of our conceptualization. It's just that the whole issue of time is the way we deal with it mentally. Then second topic, which had been taken up by several participants, and I'm not able to name them all by name, is this issue of using power to control the mind. And what I gather, what most participants felt is that this has its place as an emergency measure. But in the long run, it doesn't have such good results. And the main emphasis in the meditation practice should be on letting go. It is by giving up that sense of control, that sense of self that stands behind the sense of control, that the road to freedom unfolds. Yeah, I'm not going to go further into this because I think this has been very aptly dealt with by the participants. I just wanted to briefly mention it. But there were a number of comments on the Brahmaviharas. And if there's no question on time and power by any of those who are present now, then I go for the Brahmaviharas. Yeah, the first I have, Meng Hao Meng Shao, I hope I'm pronouncing the name correctly. He just asks a very practical question. He says, I like to ask, how are the four Brahmaviharas, the divine abodes of loving-kindness, compassion, sympathetic joy, and equanimity, how are the four Brahmaviharas used in the suttas? I'm wondering if the suttas mention how the Brahmaviharas can be used as spiritual aids. Yes, so the main description of the four Brahmaviharas as a set, we get meditation instructions. And these are the instructions that you see here on the board, which is just for the case of metta, but it is the same for the other Brahmaviharas. And then we see them used in action, so to say. There is a recurrent reference to specifically to metta, to loving kindness, or I prefer the translation benevolence. That it is part of what is expected of a monk or a nun, that they have these in bodily, verbal, and mental deeds. And so this obviously is based on this whole basic training scheme we find in the early discourses, that we give a lot of emphasis to mentally cultivating a certain attitude or a certain understanding, and then this expresses itself in the way we speak and act and deal with others, and in turn the way we speak and act, deal with others, has its repercussion on our mind again. This is where this whole training of monastics comes in, or also the type of behavior that you are asked when you go for a long retreat. And so, in this sense, the four Brahmaviharas have a very crucial role to play, because they do not only belong to what we call samatha, the development of mental tranquility as such, but at the same time, they are also required for social interaction. And most monastics do live together with other monastics and also have periodical exchange with laity. So here the Brahmaviharas have an additional perspective, an additional function besides their bare function as a development of tranquility, comparable to mindfulness of breathing or kasina practice, in that they are actually required almost for us to be able to handle relationships with others. And saying that the Brahmaviharas are a tranquility meditation object doesn't mean that they have no relation to insight, but we come to that a little later. So if we look at it from that perspective, the Brahmaviharas are of a considerable importance as spiritual aids in these ways. The next comment is by Rodolfo Rivas Molina. If when one meditates there is no inner chatting, how can you meditate on something, any object? Or in terms, how can you make an object the present moment at will if there is no will during meditation? How can you meditate on matter without an object? That is basically his question. Yeah, there's one thing about the will. There is sometimes an emphasis on the need to let go of willpower during meditation. And this is a very very relevant and keen observation from the practical perspective, that if we attempt to control the meditation, then we are continuously interfering with it. But it should be clear that this does not mean a state of mind without any kind of volition. Chetana, volition, is invariably part of every state of mind. So if somebody says no will, no volition, it is we shouldn't take that totally literal. It doesn't mean that there is no volition at all. There is still an intention of the mind to meditate, an intention of the mind to develop certain things, but this is more at the background of the state of mind in which we are, and there is more room given to let things unfold. It's a little bit maybe like you have to oversee a group of little children and you find out that it's useless to try to tell them, do this, do that, do that. It won't work. They won't listen to you. So you just sit back and you let them play however they like, but you are still there and present. And when one of them does something that it's going to be getting hurt or it's going to damage the other, then you just softly intervene. So you're not present as a dominant person in front. You allow these children to do what they're doing, but you are still present at the background and you keep this kind of monitoring quality, which is actually mindfulness, which does that during meditation. But the issue about without an object, yeah, I have been thinking about this a little bit. And it's not that we don't have any object at all in doing the Brahmavihara meditation. But maybe I go through some of the other comments which already make things a little bit clearer, and then I say what I would like to say about it. Yeah. This is from Olga Gedrimite, and she says that whenever metta naturally arises in me, then I just focus on how it feels like. And being focused on that feeling starts to grow on its own. And I just sit and observe how from the heart it emanates in all directions. This is a very nice description, and I could very much relate to that. This makes a lot of sense to me. This is what I was trying to convey last time, that one might use some type of reflection or a mental image or a memory, whatever one needs. I had the example of the map in the foreign town to find one's way. So one uses such a map, such a tool, such a crutch to get the feeling going. But once one has the feeling, then there is no longer a need for the crutch, and one just knows what it feels like and allows it to spread and pervade. And eventually, becoming familiar with the foreign town, one no longer even needs to look up the map or in terms of practice. When one becomes familiar with the feeling of a state, with mind, with metta, then one no longer needs to go to any tool or object. Yeah, maybe at this point, actually, before continuing with the others, I try to improve on the similes. I thought about how to explain the different Brahma Viharas, and last time I wasn't able offhand to come out with some sort of a simile. But in the meantime, I had time to think about it. Yeah. So if I am to describe the different Brahma Viharas, how they a different flavor is, then I thought of, let us imagine we are somewhere in a cold climate, or on a cool day in a hot climate, where sunshine is experienced as something very pleasant, where it's not this oppressive heat. Then I would say the metta, the loving kindness or benevolence, is like the sun in the sky. See, it's full of warmth and light, radiates in all directions without any distinctions, and around it there is just so much of space. And it by itself it is willing to go everywhere, the sunshine. And some people might be blocking the sunshine with something, but it doesn't matter. The sun just gives it sunshine. It doesn't bother. So that is a nice image I find for this description of metta, of loving kindness or benevolence, in this radiation way. You it's like an inner light, an inner sun, an inner warmth from the heart that radiates out in all directions. And then if I continue to develop this image with the other Brahma Viharas, I would say then Karuna, compassion, is like the setting sun in the evening. The color of the sun has changed, and darkness is close by. You have this feeling darkness is going to happen soon, darkness is near. And the Karuna, the compassion, has this. There is more an awareness of the suffering of others, or of problems or whatever. It doesn't need to be verbalized. It's just a feeling. Just as when you see the sunset, you don't need to think, oh, now it's going to be dark soon. You just have this feeling of the sun is disappearing, kind of. And if I keep on developing that same image, then for mudita, for sympathetic joy, it would be the rising sun, obviously. Early morning, the day starts, the birds are singing, there's this joyful atmosphere. If you meditate early morning, you can hear the birds outside, how they are getting ready for the day. And it's almost difficult not to have joy even in the meditation from this whole joyful atmosphere around. Yeah, and to complete my simile, and afterwards you tell me if I'm making sense or not, then the equanimity would be like the full moon. It's night. It's the full moon. It's reflecting the sunshine. The warmth is gone. But still, on a full moon night, you can see very, very clearly. And the full moon night is a very, very powerful thing, especially for those who meditate, who like to try to meditate into the night. If you sit outside and you get the moon shining on you, you can absorb almost this moonlight with your body. It's very energizing. But it has this coolness which is different from these three suns. It's a very different feeling, the full moon. If in a full moon night you can walk, you can see, but it's very different from early morning, noon or evening. So there's a very different feeling for it. But it is up in the sky, it's giving light, it has all the space around. So we have this continuity of these four images about being out in space, no boundaries, radiating in all directions, giving light, and we have these slightly different flavors to each of the three. This is the example I'm able to come up with, better than I did last time. I said something very silly about salty or so, very stupid. But anyway. Oh, somebody liked my similes. I'm glad. I've been thinking about it. Yeah. So the last I had from Olga was this very nice description of how to actually practice. Here I have something from Lisa Fancourt. She put it in last minute on the blog. Excuse me. And she says, I have often found it easier to do sitting meditation through two of the four Brahma Viharas, mudita, that is sympathetic joy, and metta, loving kindness, then by focusing attention on the breath. Somehow when I am restless or have a busy mind, the act of focusing on the breath seems to narrow the mind. When the feeling of sympathetic joy or metta arises in me, it is more relaxed and open. I have abbreviated some of what she said. What Lisa says there really, I think it's a very important aspect, and this is why I am so interested in this description in the suttas, that it brings out this flavor of the openness of the mind. And I did not get that when I was following the commentarial method of verbalizing and thinking of particular persons. And this openness of the mind, which in fact, as Lisa quite rightly points out, is an excellent way of getting started when to meditate. Usually, for many of us, especially meditating in the evening after a day of doing several things, there's a need for some transition. And this can be done by, I don't know, going jogging or practicing yoga or tai chi, some physical action. But if that is not possible or was too short, then directly sitting down and trying, now I'm meditating, zack, ready, go. It doesn't work normally. The mind jumps. And if I then try to put it in place, it can get worse. And there's some kind of openness, some open type of meditation practice that allows things to be and stands at the background of experience in such a way that those things that are open out are not disturbing the observing position. It's a very good way of transition that may later on then, if one wishes so, lead to something more specific and focused. So before I continue with, I just have one more remark and then I come to what Hedwig has said. This was made by Anne Dillon. And she said, the way object meditation was described, she was referring to a paper by Juliana, sounds similar to kasina practice. And there is a lot of similarity. Kasina actually means totality. The original idea was to develop anything, a color, an element, earth, water, fire, air, as a totality, so that perception of the meditator is totally engulfed in this one kind of thing. And eventually it comes to stand for the devices that, according to Visuddhimagga, are used for this type of meditation, where one makes some kind of a round object and concentrates on that round object. Suppose a blue, and I just have here my little thing here, something like this. So this is just for my a cup. And so you have some round object that is a bluish color, and you look at it, and then you close your eyes and remember it. You look at it, close your eyes, look at it, close your eyes. Eventually, with closed eyes, you're able to see this round object. And at some point, this round blue color is going to open up and everything is going to become blue. And you are going to become engulfed in blueness, so to say. And this is a kasina practice. Kasina, this is called. But kasina or kritsna, the Sanskrit, originally actually means totality. And I thought the comment by Andilan was very interesting because there's a lot of similarity, just that the procedure is different. We don't have a small object that we expand, but we have this radiation to which I'm going to turn in a little while, which we have here on the board. There was a question by Hedwig. How does the feeling of sympathetic joy feel different from the piti sukha one can experience in samadhi and vipassana meditation? It has a lot of similarity between them. I was saying last time there's a lot of similarity between sympathetic joy and joy in general. And this is even terminology wise, mudita, then there's this anumodana, the rejoicing, and mudumana. It all has a lot of similarity between them. But if it is practiced within the context of the Brahma Viharas, in the long run, one can feel that there's a difference. Again, I'm getting all these wonderful questions, and then I go like, I'm going to explain this now. Well, last time I had that, and I came up with this nice sun simile. I'm not sure if I'm going to be able to give a beautiful simile for Hedwig next week, but somehow I think that the mudita is more a mental attitude, and the joy I get in the tranquility meditation and insight meditation is more like a factor of the mind. Yeah, that doesn't make much practical sense, I know, but it's the best I can come up at now. But it is a little bit like that. You see, the joy in concentration, even in deep concentration, also the joy in insight is part of something else. And the sympathetic joy, this is more like the overall thing. This is the best I can do. Julia Martini says, mudita doesn't have rapture to it in my experience. Yes, but it can. Yeah, it is usually because piti sukha is more exciting, mudita is more tranquil. Yeah, Juliana and Rosa Grau are pointing in the same direction. Maybe there's something to add. Yeah. Maybe I need another week to think of a simile. And if I don't find a simile the next week, I'm not going to talk, no? Yeah. I sometimes get little thrills of rapture in the mudita practice. Especially if there has been some kind of a blockage and it breaks through. And the piti is definitely more exciting, but then the sukha is less exciting. Piti sukha, Mark says, piti sukha still seems body-based, whereas mudita has no limit. Aha! Right, the radiation, Mark. Mark, I think that was really helpful, at least to me. Right, the mudita is radiating out. And the piti sukha, the joy and happiness normally is not really radiating out. How about karuna and upekka? Andrew asks, do they have rapture to it? Interestingly, they do. That was a question that really bothered me for some time. I thought, how does one get into equanimity as a Brahma Vihara if you cannot develop the lower jhanas with it, because upekka is without joy? It is not without joy. Very fascinating. Even the upekka has some joy to it. And Karuna definitely has some joy to it. But it's nevertheless good to do as the suttas, I think, suggest, to really take a firm stand on loving kindness, the benevolence, the metta practice. Like I wouldn't start with upekkha, because it seems to me that the firm basis in metta is making sure that the other three go in the right direction. I was saying last time that the compassion needs to be based on the metta in order to avoid having too much an attitude towards as if I'm better than the others. There's a danger. Need not necessarily be, but there's a danger that it could be condescending. And for the mudita, I think when it comes based on metta, then it will not be simply joy, just simply, oh, that's nice, kind of. It will really be that rounding off of one's attitude towards others. And I think what most of you have said, and yeah, I'm learning a lot again today. Thank you. Yeah, I think there's a point to it. It is not so rapturous. I think Juliana and Rosa are right. And I think Mark has really, really hit me again, once more, that the mudita is really related to the radiation. It has this feeling of spreading out, whereas the piti and the sukha do not necessarily have that. Very helpful. No, joy is the center of the wheel. Yeah, Lisa, that is in the awakening factors. That was what I was trying to say the other time, that joy is so it's like the hub of the wheel of meditation, as in the Bhujanga, and the awakening factor stands right at the center, and it's something that is related to both the development of insight and the development of tranquility. Juliana, mudita seems to have a more ethical nuance. Happiness at feeling the goodness of the heart, good karma, such as in anumodana. It's not exciting, more sukha, just happy. Yeah, I think what you said before, yeah, it's not so thrilling. Listen, yes, the function and purpose of this is really important for me to understand as a practitioner. What is the purpose? Where is this leading? The purpose is purification of the mind. It is going to lead to freedom. Buddhism recognizes different types of freedom. Not all freedom is ultimate. There is freedom of the mind, cetu vimuti, that comes through the development of tranquility alone. This is already in itself highly beneficial, very much recommended, often talked about in the discourses. And this type of mental freedom, where the defilements have not yet been eradicated, is an excellent basis for the development of insight that then leads to lasting freedom, the type of liberation where the defilements have been liberated. So the Brahma Viharas have the function of being an important part of the path of liberation, the path of mental purification. They fulfill the purpose of tranquility. They are an excellent basis for the development of insight. And as I was trying to say before, they also fulfill the purpose of easing our social relationships, of teaching us four attitudes that in themselves cover all the responses required in whatever situation you may imagine. So in this sense, I think that they are of extreme importance. And I personally think that especially for us Westerners, and I had that problem myself, the Brahma Viharas are particularly good for the development of the aspect of mental tranquility, because they, especially in this radiation manner, they do not so easily allow us to control things. This was my problem with mindfulness of breathing. This is why I related so much to what you said, Lisa, on mindfulness of breathing, that I was all the time trying to control. And they also bring about a type of mental healing, if I may call it like this. There's one famous Tibetan Rinpoche, and I'm sorry, I forgot his name, but he, at one point, he's quoted as having said that the problem with people in the West is that they are all hungry ghosts. You first have to teach them meditation so they become human beings, and afterwards you can start insight. And I thought that was, it was a stark saying, but there was a lot to it. Many Westerners, and this is what I experience with people in meditation courses, carry with them wounds from the past that need healing, and it is only then possible to go for the stronger aspects of insight meditation. I think somebody has put it like you need to first have a self in order to understand not self. And so with the have a self, I think the point was you have to first integrate yourself. You have to first become a full person before you can understand that not self is freedom. And last time Rodolfo had so nicely depicted what happens when one overdoes inside. I can't quote it offhand now, but he had this whole beautiful description of everything is not self and you can't even kill yourself. And that was a very nice example of how things can go overboard. So my personal feeling is that if I can, I never give recommendation for people to go here and there and meditate, but if I can give a general recommendation of meditation practice, I would always recommend Brahmaviharas. Always, especially Metta. Very, very useful basis, many, many benefits. And it is even relevant to continue on the topic that you have said, the purpose and function. It is particularly relevant not only for the beginner, it is also specifically relevant for the progress from stream entry to non-return, actually. Because loving kindness, by the fact that it develops inner joy and happiness, weans the mind from desire for sensual pleasures. And by its very nature of being opposed to anger and hatred, it also takes care of the other main defilement. There's two main defilements that the stream enterer has to face. One is sensual desire, the second is anger and hatred and aversion. And so the development of loving kindness catches both in a single go. It takes care of both. This is why in many discourses, in Pali discourses and Chinese agamas, we get this saying, and now forgive me one more time, little Pali, metta cetu vimutti bhavita bahulikata anagamitaya sangvatantati. The liberation of the mind through benevolence leads to non-return. It leads to a very high level of freedom for one who has the insight of a stream enterer, obviously. But I'm chattering and here are more comments, so let me see. Mark, eventually we may drop Pitisukha, we never drop Mudita or the other Brahmaviharas. Mudita goes all the way through to Nibbana, is this correct? Yes and no, Mark. I mean, even the Arahant might go into a second or first jhana and experience Pitisukha. So the progression through the four jhanas up to a level of the fourth jhana where you drop third jhana, you drop Piti, third, fourth, you drop Pitisukha. It's just how you can refine the jhanas, and how you refine the Brahmaviharas is at the Upekkha level. This does not mean that the Arahant only has Upekkha. He or she will have all four Brahmaviharas at their disposition. The Buddha had a lot of karuna, compassion. So one is not limited to these, but there's a cycle that one goes through with the jhanas by dropping Pitisukha and with the Brahmaviharas by moving up to Upekkha. Andrew, Lai. Does Upekkha naturally arise from Metta Bhavana, last of Bojanga, or does one have to switch Metta Bhavana to Upekkha Bhavana? Upekkha as a awakening factor, Andrew, is slightly different than equanimity as divine abode. And the four divine abodes, the four Brahma Viharas, do not naturally arise from the practice of loving kindness or benevolence. The loving kindness or benevolence is the basis, and it is the one practice that I feel, as far as I understand the discourses, is the one that should be emphasized, made the basis. But once this is established, you will have to make a conscious effort to integrate the others. Like if I may say my own practice, usually, I mean, I sit many hours, so usually I will sit almost half of the time in metta, and then the other half of the time I portion it up and go through the other three. But my practice is not really complete if I stay only with metta, and the rest doesn't come naturally. There's a conscious decision. At some point I feel, okay, now it's time, and then there's a conscious decision, a change of my mental attitude, where I move from metta to karuna, to compassion. In fact, it was precisely when I was doing that, that I thought, I got my simile for the next course. That's when I got the sun during my last retreat on last Sunday. That's when I got the image of the sun setting. Because I was flavoring that difference of the compassion, and I was thinking like, I was getting into a more kind of reflective mode, and was thinking like, how can I communicate that? How can I express that? Yeah, and that's a conscious decision, and when one is well established in the loving kindness practice, it is meaningful to extend the practice, but one should first be well established in it, in the metta, not make it difficult at the beginning, because the beauty of this practice is the simplicity and openness. And that simplicity and openness should not get lost by making it complicated for oneself, by thinking, oh no, I have to get this one, and wait, is it now karuna, is it mudita, well, what is the next one? So taking it easy and just seeing that there is something more to this practice. At some point in the future, I'll take up these other aspects. This is just my suggestion. There are a few typings. Yeah, Mark, I'm just hitting in something I have here, and then you come. Yeah, there's a comment by Sister Kinchana, and she was saying metta without object, she understands that as with a general object, all beings or whatever is there. The Brahma Viharas are also described as unlimited, appamanya. And I thought that was very, very relevant. So I would like to a little bit correct what we said last time. So I would not say it's without an object. The object is boundlessness. And this boundlessness has become one with the mind that has metta. And I just, if we can look for a moment again here at the blackboard, and I just read it one more time. So, dwell pervading one direction. It means you have aroused the state of metta, and you allow it to radiate in one direction, usually in front, say. And then likewise the second, so you kind of open up the right side, and then the third, you open up the back side, and then the fourth, you open up the left side. And the four intermediate directions, you make sure it goes all around. There's no gap. And then it moves up, the whole upper part is being covered. And then it moves down. Everything downwards is radiating in all direction. And you make sure all around it's like a ball. There's no, like a ball that has no hole, so the air cannot go out. It's complete. It's going everywhere. But this ball does not have a fixed surface. It's just like light, like the sun. Yeah. Like the sun, just radiating the sunlight in all directions. So it does have an object. The object is limitlessness, all directions, if you like. And it is at the same time also, metta is the object, because the mind that has been loaded with metta has become one with this boundless space. So you can say the object is metta, the mind with metta that has become boundless, or you can say the object is boundlessness. But the instruction we are getting here is clearly giving us some aid. It's not leaving us in a complete like, hey, how do I do this now? What am I supposed to do? I mean, it is giving us some way of working with it. And it is useful also for those who start to go slowly, just work with one direction. And then slowly move up the next one. Not just go, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, I got it. Huh? Yeah. So I think that when we say without object, we just mean it's there's no person as an object. It will affect persons, anybody in the area, animals, whatever. And it will also be possible to use it in interrelationship. But as an actual meditation practice, there is no need to bring in confined objects. Objects that have boundaries. We have infinite object. Boundless object. Mark, I have a question about the use of the heart. Olga uses the same approach I do in that she uses the heart center as the source of the unlimited radiance. I find this easy and useful as well. What are the pros and cons, if any, of using the heart as the center? Yeah, it depends on what we mean when we say heart. I understood Olga to mean the mental heart. That's just the center of the body where the mind is, not the physical heart. That is usually what the Hadayavatu in Pali, and I think it's somewhere in the Abhidhamma, Akinshana will be able to tell us. I think in the Patana, it's not mentioned directly, it's just mentioned indirectly, but there is this idea that the mind arises based on the heart. Now, if we talk about the physical heart, there's the physical heart and the brain are two parts of the body where it is good to be a little circumspect before focusing on them in a strong manner. If it is done in this kind of open way as a starting point for metta meditation, that is not so much a problem. But the brain and the heart are areas where focusing very strongly on them in the body can create physical problems. I know cases where people have begun to interfere with the heartbeat through their misguided meditation. I know one person who has completely messed up his meditation by focusing on pain in the brain and focusing, and the brain has become not gone away anymore for years now because of that. So brain and the heart are things that one might, if you do like a body scan or a thing, you just move through, that's fine. If you have it just as a loose reference point, it's fine. But I understood you mean the heart chakra. We are perfectly fine, Mark. I just wanted to use this opportunity to mention these two areas of the human body which are not suitable for strong, energetic focusing of the mind because it simply can create physical problems. Juliana, to me, the Brahma Vihara, however beautiful, can be a little tiring too. To stay with the simile of the sun, sometimes it gets a little too much, too bright. So naturally, we can proceed towards cooler ones, up to Upekkha, but then one just wants to let it all go. Is there something wrong in the practice if it goes like that, towards its own end? Yeah, I think if it becomes tiring, then the very fact that it becomes tiring means that there must have been some effort. And if there has been some effort, then I am not sure if that is really what the idea is. So perhaps, I mean, it's a little difficult to say offhand, but perhaps a way would be to just allow this is Brahma Vihara to be without trying to make it to be something. The radiation, the sun doesn't have to do anything to shine, it just moves to the sky. If you use that image, then this effect of getting tired may not be there. But it should, in principle, be possible to stay within any of these Brahma Viharas and develop them up. up to jhana level without getting tired of it in any way? That is, in fact, the question Stuart has. I'm a little confused. Can you go straight from metta to jhana without going through the other? Oh, yeah, definitely. Definitely. In fact, if possible, I think it would be very useful to develop metta up to at least first jhana level, if not second, before going for the other Brahma Viharas, because then it's really well established. Not tired from the effort, just from the experience itself. But how can this experience be tiring, Juliana? I don't see that. You might just want to look if there's some effort there that you haven't noticed before. I just don't see how this experience can be tiring as such. It's simply a genuine openness of the mind. This is a state of mind of arahants. This is just the feeling that arahants have when they interrelate with each other. They have metta towards each other. The karuna is just the feeling the Buddha has when he teaches. How can that be tiring? Mark, so do you recommend radiating from the heart center? I'm not clear on this. I think this is a very meaningful suggestion. Yeah, I'm not giving meditation instructions. This is a university course. So but it makes a lot of sense. Yeah, there's still two more comments. Olga Gedrimite, she says, being familiar with how it actually feels to feel metta, it becomes so easy to make it arise in any situation so far when needed. For example, when a slight aversion arises in the mind. But then a question arose, how actually to balance practice of vipassana and metta? Yeah. Yeah, Olga, that was two beautiful things. Thank you. One, in fact, that is a thing I very much relate to. had that experience when I started to do this type of metta meditation. No, you want to get another story? Yeah, I was living in Sri Lanka and I was going begging every morning. And I always had to go by the place where there were a lot of street dogs. And Mark has already told about the street dogs. And somehow they always come and start barking when I came. And that was a little... it's a little difficult to handle that because, you know, they come very close and two times even one of them started to pull at my ropes, like biting it and pulling. But at the same time, you're a monk, you're supposed not to show any anger or do anything. You're not supposed to react in any way. You're supposed to be looking like you're meditating, very calm, walking down the road, barefooted, hoping somebody gives you food, no? So that was one of those little challenges every day on my begging tours there in Sri Lanka to how do I deal with these street dogs now? And when I started to practice this metta, then I had different routes, so I was again coming through the road where all the dogs were, and I kind of, without thinking about it, I just started to practice metta. And the funny thing was, dogs, they saw me from afar, and they came, wah, 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 and they came closer and closer, and then they, someone must have felt that metta. Anyway, they ran past me and kept barking. There was nothing to bark, but somehow this metta energy, this kind of, that I was not getting all anxious about, oh my God, they're going to pull out my robes. How am I going to do now? All this, how am I going to look now in front of all the people? Excuse me. All this stuff had just gone and I was just letting happen whatever and having this metta. And because of this metta attitude, kind of the thing they were barking at, there was no resistance, I think. This is the way I explain it. And so they kind of went past me and I kept walking and they kept barking at nothing and then they went back and sat down somewhere. And since then, I never had a problem anymore with these street dogs. From then on, there was no more reaction when they saw me. They sometimes just came and looked a little bit and then went off again. But because before I had been even a subtle kind of aversion, nervousness within me had been, and children feel that, animals and children feel your energy. They had felt that energy and they had reacted on that. But now the real question that Olga has been asking, not just for me to get rid of my stories again, question arose, how actually to balance practice of vipassana and metta, and this is really the very crucial, very important question. There's a comment by Rodolfo that dogs can smell adrenaline, and Rosa that dogs won't bite you if you're not afraid of them. Yeah, I didn't know that earlier, but I agree now. how to balance the practice of insight and the metta meditation. This is actually very important, and I think what we need to understand is that tranquility and insight are two complementary qualities in the suttas. There's sometimes in modern days we get some that they tell us only insight, forget about the other. And then in response to that, the others, they say only samatha, only tranquility, forget about the other will come automatically. I am not really comfortable with both approaches, because my feeling is that both tranquility and insight have their real place, and this is what I see in the suttas. And so when the time is there and you're practicing, say, metta, and you feel you're getting into some deeper concentration, then that time it should really be, the mind should be allowed that experience. It should be allowed to go deeper. There should not be an attempt to force in insight in some way. And there's a simile I like to give to my Sri Lankan students. It doesn't work so well here in the West, but I still like to tell that simile. You see, in Sri Lanka we have all this, we eat by fingers, and you have to continuously clean the plate, because here in the West, after you've eaten, you clean the plate, and the next day you can take out the plate and just eat from it. But in Sri Lanka, the problem is there's a lot of dust, there's also cockroaches everywhere, so you also need to clean the plate just before you eat, even if it looks like clean, because you might get something. So there is this rule, kind of rule, whenever you get hold of a plate, you must clean the plate. And this is a little bit like the rule we have, whatever you do in your meditation, you have to practice insight. So you have to see impermanence, dukkha, and not self, or whatever. However, I tell my students, when you get your plate, and you've just put the food on top of it, is that a good time to clean the plate? And they say, nay. Yeah, that's not a good time to clean the plate, no? When the whole of the food is on your plate, that's the time to eat. So when the food of metta or whatever other tranquility object you practice is on your plate, that's not the time to clean it. Because if you clean it, all the food is gone lost. So that's the time to eat. You eat, you enjoy. You allow the natural tendency of the mind to look for happiness, you give it that happiness. You let it have that stillness. There is naturally going to be a time when the plate is empty. When you have eaten, you're full. When the mind naturally is less concentrated, that's the time for insight. And that is a must at that time to practice insight. And it's so wonderful to practice insight at that time. And it's so powerful. So when the mind naturally comes out of the concentration, when the concentration becomes less, you realize, look, things are changing. I had this bliss and happiness, and now it's becoming less. And precisely this is insight into impermanence. And it is a very powerful insight into impermanence, because what you have just been experienced was so deep, so powerful, so full of happiness and bliss. And even that changes, let alone other things. And at that time, this insight fulfills a number of functions. It fulfills first of all, the function of helping you next time. Why? Because if at the end of your present tranquility sitting, you have trained in letting go of what just happened, next time you sit down, you will not get the regular problem many of us have is, last time it was like this, let me see if it's coming again. That is just the thing to do, not to have it happen again. Expectation. Not being in the present moment. Thinking of what things should be like instead of allowing them just to be as they are. So it's absolutely crucial, even just talking about samatha, to let go of whatever has happened, so for the next time, the mind can start fresh. And all the more for the insight. In fact, one very, very famous monk, reputedly an arahant in Sri Lanka, who has passed away recently, he has this very, very stark saying. He was asked, what is vipassana? And he just said, vipassana? The anicca of the jhana experience. It means insight is the seeing the impermanence of deep experience of concentration. It's a very powerful experience of impermanence. And so there it has its full place. And you're also more agile. You're coming out of the concentration. You're still somewhat concentrated. But the mind is ready to take in more than just one thing. It wants to open up. Allow it to open up and use that for insight. In that way you're catching two in one go. And Juliana has given a quote even for that, and I'm just pasting it in, and then I have a look for the what the others are saying. She said, she has quoted from the Sutta, Majjhima Nikaya 52, this liberation of the mind through matter is conditioned and intentionally produced, but whatever is conditioned and intentionally produced is impermanent, subject to cessation. That's it. This profound state of mind that you just experience, hey, it's just the product of my practice, that's all. Just a product of the mind. Because of my keeping morality, sitting down to meditate, etc., I got this. Now it's becoming less, it's going to pass away. I let go of it. Very simple. And very, very powerful. Yeah, Juliana is again saying the feeling of tiredness I was talking about has to do with what you're saying now, sort of getting tired from within, self-tired, I don't know how to put it. Yeah, I think I have an idea, Juliana, but I think it's not, maybe we discuss that on another occasion, because that goes a little, what I think of now is a little very personal, not to be discussed maybe in front of everybody. And after having spent most of my time with meditation, my favorite topic, now we're going to get back to the discourse so that at least they don't say, well, it's still a university course, isn't it? No. So, we're going to Majjhima Nikaya 28. Again, Sariputta is visiting somebody who is sick. This time it is Anathapindika. Anathapindika is a famous householder in early Buddhist discourses, a very generous donor who supported the Buddha and the monks. Yeah, I had a whole thing on him, but I think I'm a little bit running out of time, I'll be not saying so much about him. I just go straight into the discourse. The Venerable Sariputta asked, how is your ailment now, householder? How much are you eating and drinking? Are your painful feelings subsiding, not increasing? And the householder Anathapindika replied, my ailment is becoming critical. I cannot eat or drink. My painful feelings are increasing, not subsiding. The Venerable Sariputta said, don't be afraid, householder. Don't be afraid. Why not? In the case of ignorant, ordinary worldlings who are wanting in faith, with the breaking up of the body at death, they go to a bad realm of existence, being reborn in hell. But you now, householder, are not wanting in faith. Rather, you are of superior faith. By recalling your superior faith, householder, you may be able to extinguish your pain and give rise to happiness. By relying on your superior faith, householder, you may attain the fruit of once returning, or even the fruit of non-returning, as you have already attained stream entry. Yeah, so basically the situation is our Anathapindika is very sick, and this time Sariputta is again giving a teaching to a sick person, but now he is building on the qualities that Anathapindika already has, and he teaches him recollection of these qualities. And this is in fact an important practical gist of this sutta for us to see the importance of being aware not only of our defects, but also of our good qualities, and to recollect them. This is not about creating an ego, but is giving us strength for the practice. So the qualities that according to the Madhyama Agama version he should recollect besides his faith or confidence would be a translation I personally prefer are virtue, learning, generosity, wisdom, right view, right intention, right understanding, right liberation, and right knowledge. Now, if we look at the Pali parallel, the faith, which was just a single quality in the Madhyama Agama, has become threefold. We have faith in Buddha, faith in Dharma, and faith in community. And we have virtue again. See, learning and generosity do not come, wisdom also don't come, but here we get the whole list of the tenfold path factor, right view, right intention, right speech, right action, right livelihood, right effort, right mindfulness, right concentration, right knowledge, and right liberation. There's a problem here, and I'm gonna quote Bhikkhu Bodhi on that. Yeah, I think I paraphrase. He quotes another discourse. And he says, it is said that the trainee in the practice is 8 factors, the arahant 10. Yeah, so from right view to right concentration, this is the eight factors of the Eightfold Noble Path. But the last two, right knowledge and right liberation, are qualities only of an arahant. Anathapindika was not an arahant. And you see, we have right liberation, right knowledge also in the Madhyama Agama. So here, Bhikkhu Bodhi, I continue here. Yet here, strangely, the last two factors, Samanyana and Samavimutti, which are supposed to be unique to the Arahant, are ascribed to the stream enterer Anathapindika. The last line of the sutta confirms that this was not a mere editorial oversight. We will come to that last line later. For another example of such anomalies, see 47.13. This is another discourse in the Samyutta Nikaya, where two factors of an arahant, liberation and knowledge and vision of liberation, are ascribed to the trainee. So if you look at the discourse that Venerable Bodhi has pointed out to us, we have there the statement, this is a situation when Sariputta has just passed away, he has just died. Ananda is very sad. He tells the Buddha, look, Sariputta has just died. And then the Buddha says, why? Sariputta has died, but has he taken away your aggregate of virtue? I mean, has he taken your virtue away with him? Is it also gone? Or has he taken your aggregate of concentration? It's a very, very nice way of helping Ananda to kind of see that, well, Sariputta has passed away, but he has not taken away all the qualities that you have. So, has he taken away your aggregate of wisdom? Has he taken away your aggregate of liberation or your aggregate of knowledge and vision of liberation? And the phrasing is clear. Kinnute Ananda is talking, has he taken it away from you? And there's a very nice finding I made when I checked the parallel, the Samyukta Agama parallel. It does not have this you. So I hope I'm not being too unclear here. The point is, I try to say it again, the Pali version, in the Pali version, the Buddha is speaking as if Ananda were an arahant, because the question seems to be, Ananda, has Sariputta taken away the aggregate of liberation and knowledge and vision of liberation from you, which Ananda is only a stream entry. It can't be taken away from him because he doesn't have it in the first place. In the Samyukta Agama parallel, we do not get the question you. And I'm just pasting in here for those of you who read Chinese. I just paste in the Chinese here. So there, it is just a general question. Has Sariputta taken away these aspects, and it's not specifically on Ananda. So here we see that it's just this little te here in the Pali version which makes the difference. So if we leave out that te and assume that this has come in through some editorial transmission mistake, whatever, then the whole thing makes sense, and there's no longer a problem with 47.13 because it's just a general statement. Has Sariputta, by passing away, taken away these aggregates, these aspects in general? But in the case of the discourse we are concerned here now, we do not get the solution to the problem. We see that there's a difference. You see, here we do not get the full listing, or we only get 10 qualities altogether, but we have right liberation, right knowledge. And here we get the whole tenfold path. So from the practical perspective, interesting for us is that this recollection of his qualities helps our anatta-pindika, we are back to our sutta here, to overcome his sickness, and he becomes normal again. He recovers from his disease. And he gets up into the sitting position and he says, "Ah, very good, very good. Your teaching of the Dharma to this sick man was marvelous, very special. Venerable Sariputta, on hearing your Dharma teaching for a sick man, my pain has been extinguished and happiness has been aroused. Venerable Sariputta, my illness has now vanished and my condition has returned to normal." It's an interesting testimony for the power of positive recollection. Yeah, and at the end of the discourse, I thought I had it here, but it doesn't seem to be here, no? The Buddha praises them. Let me see if I have it here. Yeah, so in the Samyutta Nikaya version, then Anatta Pindika gives Sariputta a meal. And then when they come back to the Buddha, it's actually Ananda, the Buddha praises Sariputta. And in the Madhyama Agama, we get a much longer story. But before I get into that longer story, I just want to see. There's a final saying here that, by when we have that in both versions, that the Buddha says that Sariputta has taught the four limbs of stream entry in a tenfold manner. The four limbs of stream entry are faith in the Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha, and virtue. These are the four ways. These are the four qualities of a stream enterer. And this 4 and 10 is interesting. We have altogether 10 qualities in the Madhyama Agama, and we have 14 qualities, you see, 1, 2, 3, 4, and the 10 path factors in the Samyutta Nikaya. So, trying to find a solution for this problem of right liberation, right knowledge, my suggestion would be that at some point in the transmission, the original point could have been, this is just a hypothesis, the original point of the listing could have been faith, just a simple faith or confidence, which implies the three we have here in the Pali, that would be one. And virtue, we have in both, faith and virtue two. And then the eightfold path. Those two and eight would make 10. The stream enterer is endowed with the eightfold path. That would be a meaningful statement for a stream enterer. And that in the course of transmission, for some reason or another, in both versions, this listing got somehow mixed up. I mean, the two versions probably come from some ancestral version, sometime removed from the original delivery of the discourse. So in some way, something has gone wrong. I can't fully explain it, but that is my only hypothesis. And it's clear that right liberation and right knowledge do not fit somebody who is not an arahant. So something has gone wrong here. Anyhow, Rosa, can this day be a kind of deity of interest? Well, Rosa, that's not the way Bhikkhu Bodhi takes it, and I have to look up now what the commentary says. I can do that later on. I don't have the time now for that. It would be nice to see what the commentary says, how they take that statement. Yeah. Good. I think I'm now gonna be going very quick through the rest because I want to get us started on the next topic. Okay. What I have now, you see, the rest of this Madhyama Agama discourse is very, very long. It gives all kind of different things about Anathapindika. Anathapindika, now he has recovered. You remember the situation. He gets this teaching. He recollects his good qualities. He recovers. And then he starts to tell Sariputta about his first meeting when he met the Buddha for the first time. There's an interesting little difference here. That, and I have translated this for you from the Madhyama Agama here. There's a story about Anathapindika. He is visiting somebody. The person is preparing a big meal. He asks, for whom is that meal? There's a Buddha. What? A Buddha work? Can I meet him? Yeah, you go out here. And then he goes out in the middle of the night and it's still too early and it's all very, very, very dramatic. Finally, he makes his way. He arrives there. The Buddha is, I believe, somewhere outside. And so he walks up, and in the Madhyama Agama version, the Buddha says, what is your name? How do people in Savatthi address you? And he says, my name is Sudatta, but because I regularly assist and give to the needy and the orphan, the people of Savatthi call me Anathapindika. That means the giver to the needy and the orphan. We have the same story in the Pali Vinaya, but there we get a little, one of those little miracles. So I have only given the Pali, I'm sorry. So this is their first meeting. The Bhagava, the blessed the Buddha, says to Anathapindika, hey, Sudatta, come Sudatta. And then Anathapindika thinks, wow, the Blessed One is speaking to me by my name, because this name Sudatta was not really known. It was his private name. He was always known as Anathapindika. And he gets very, very happy and very pleased by that and approaches the Buddha. So we have here a little miracle, and judging from the Madhyama Agama version, this miracle may be a later development where the Buddha is depicted as recognizing, mentally reading the Anathapindika's name and then arousing his faith. But this may not be an original story, given that all of the discourse collection, as we have them, tend to invest the Buddha with miracles and miraculous powers. So if the Madhyama Agama reciters would have known, they would certainly not have taken out that miracle. They would also have had the passage when the Buddha just says, hello, Sudatta, and Sudatta says, he knows my name, shoo. But here it's just very simple, what's your name? And he says it. Well, that's just a little story. Then I had, I have to be very quick on all these things now. This is a depiction of the donation of Jeta's Grove. Jeta's Grove is the place where most of the discourses are situated, and we have the impression that it was the place where the Buddha spent a lot of time, many of his rainy season retreats. And there's a story which Anathapindika in this Madhyama Agama discourse tells Sariputta that it was difficult to get this grove. He wanted the Buddha to come to Savatthi, and this prince Jeta had this grove, and the prince says, I'm not going to give you this grove even if you cover its ground with gold. And Anathapindika said, done, I'll do it. And he covered the floor with gold. And the Jeta said, no, I didn't mean it like that. But the judges said, no, if you have set a price, the price is being paid, you have to give him the grove. Beautiful story to show us depict the generosity of this eminent householder. And here we get a depiction of these people who are, these little square things are the pieces of gold, and there's another fella at the back who is just coming to bring the next load of gold to cover the ground. Ah, yeah, here I have the final statement, I'm sorry. Yeah, so I just read it again to conclude my earlier discourse. The Buddha says at the end of the Madhyama Agama discourse, also similar to the Pali, the monk Sariputta is endowed with bright wisdom, quick wisdom, lively wisdom, keen wisdom, extensive wisdom, profound wisdom, wisdom that brings release, penetrative wisdom, eloquent wisdom. I'm not sure if that is in the Pali, but now it comes. Why is that? Regarding the four limbs of stream entry taught in brief by me, the monk Sariputta has elaborated on them with 10 different explanations for the householder Nata Pindika. That the point of this is just this four limbs of stream entry in a tenfold manner as a concluding statement in both discourses, whereas the actual listings, one has 10, one has 14 qualities, differ. Yeah, I wanted to talk about Anatta Pindika in other discourses, but I'm leaving that out. Yeah, so the main point that this discourse is conveying us is the power of recollecting one's own good qualities. The good things one does are worthwhile recollecting, and this is a practice that is useful in everyday life to strengthen them, if one is obviously not creating an ego. It is something that is helpful in disease, and it's also something that is usually recommended at the time of death. That's something that points the mind in a wholesome direction. So just as it is important to recognize our defects and negative qualities, so it is important to also be aware of our positive parts. I think that is the main thing, the main aspect that we can take along from this discourse. Yeah, still got 15 minutes, so able to start with the next discourse and get into the Four Noble Truths or the Four Truths. Madhyama Agama 29. Pali parallel is Majjhima Nikaya 9. We also have a parallel in the Samyukta Agama and Sanskrit fragments. The setting is a little different. Here in the Madhyama Agama it is Sariputta who is asking questions of another monk by the name of Mahakotita. In the Pali and the other version it's the other way around. Mahakotita is asking questions of Sariputta. Mahakotita is one of the foremost disciples of the Buddha also, not as famous as Sariputta, but also among the well-known disciples, and he is particularly known for his ability in logical analysis. Yeah, no need for him to go into any further into Mahakotita. Sariputta and Mahakotita apparently were good friends. And for us to understand this type of discussion, it is important. This is in some way a long distant precedent for the Tibetan practice of debate. You might have seen that, especially I think in the Gelu tradition. There's this, not only in the Gelu, but I think I've seen Gelu monks doing it, this tradition where two monks, to strengthen their understanding, debate certain points. And it looks quite pictorial. One of them is, they have this slapping kind of thing, and it's very animated. And we have here, this is not a debate as such, but it is a discussion where two who both know. It's not that one of them doesn't know and needs explanation from the other. It's more like both know, and for the clarification of others, they engage in an exchange where one asks the question and the other will give the answers. So Venerable Sariputta asked, I'm reading the discourse, Venerable friend Mahakotita, is there a condition owing to which a monk accomplishes view, acquires right view, and having attained unwavering pure confidence in the Dharma, arrives at the true Dharma? he is asking about stream entry. At stream entry, one has acquired right view and has unwavering confidence in the Dharma and has arrived at the true Dharma because one has had the first taste of Nirvana at stream entry. So the replies we get, there's a whole series of replies, and today we're probably only going to be looking at the first two. Venerable Mahakotita replied, there is Venerable Sariputta. It is this. A monk knows the unwholesome and knows the roots of the unwholesome. What is knowledge of the unwholesome? It is this. Evil bodily actions are unwholesome. Evil verbal actions and evil mental actions are unwholesome. This is reckoned to be knowledge of the unwholesome. What is knowledge of the roots of the unwholesome? It is this. Greed is a root of the unwholesome. Hatred and ignorance are roots of the unwholesome. Venerable Sariputta, if there is a monk who in this manner knows the unwholesome and the roots of the unwholesome, then he is said to be a monk who has accomplished view, acquired right view, and having attained unwavering pure confidence in the Dharma, has arrived at the true Dharma. So Sariputta approves, and then he asks for another way. These are alternate descriptions of qualities of stream entry. And in reply, Mahakotita gives us the same, just with the topic of wholesomeness. So if somebody knows the wholesome and the roots of the wholesome, and the knowledge of a wholesome is then good bodily, verbal and mental actions, and the roots is the absence of lust, absence of aversion, and absence of ignorance. Yeah. In the parallel versions, we get these first two as one. And that makes much more sense. The clear understanding of what is wholesome automatically means that I clearly understand what is unwholesome. Conversely, clearly understanding what is unwholesome, I will also know what is wholesome. So my impression is that here, at some point in the transmission of the Madhyama Agama version, these two qualities were accidentally split. This can very easily happen during oral transmission. And then this whole para here on a monk who in this matter knows was then added to the first and the second instance. This is a very typical error that can happen. And then Sariputta's question, is there another condition? Can easily happen during oral transmission. There's no point. This is one of these nice examples that any editor making such a change would be meaningless. There's nothing gained by this. There's no advantage. It's just a typical type of error we get in oral transmission where somehow when you recite, there's a little slip and it splits up into two. And after that, because you get it from your teacher in this way, you pass it on in the same way and nobody kind of goes to correct that. But it's clearly, from the practical viewpoint, we are just talking about one topic. Now, in the Pali version, there's another passage which I think is a transmission error. And this makes this is a rather substantial issue. This is one of my first discoveries when I started comparative studies. One of my first paper I wrote on comparative studies, I point out this and I feel like I really found something. Yeah, because it has been puzzling me all the time. You see, the whole topic here is stream entry. But in here I'm reading Bhikkhu Bodhi's, Bhikkhu Nyanamoli's translation edited by Bhikkhu Bodhi. When a noble disciple has thus understood the unwholesome and the root of the unwholesome, the wholesome and the root of the wholesome, he entirely abandons the underlying tendency to lust. He abolishes the underlying tendency to aversion. He extirpates the underlying tendency to view and the conceit I am. And by abandoning ignorance and arousing true knowledge, and here now makes an end of suffering. This is a description of an arahant, not of a stream enterer. Still, we get the final part in this way. Two, a noble disciple is one of right view, whose view is straight, who has perfect confidence in the Dhamma and has arrived at this true Dhamma. Yeah, so this clearly is out of context. The whole discussion is about right view and stream entry. And this right view, at the point of attaining right view, one has not yet done with the underlying tendency. One still has the conceit, I am, even only subtle. And ignorance still needs to be abandoned, and an end of suffering or dukkha needs to be made. Yeah, so this we have in both versions instances of problems with oral transmission. So I have numbered it here, the second topic, disregarding that the Madhyama Agama has split the first topic into two. A monk knows nutriment as it really is, knows the rising of nutriment, knows the cessation of nutriment, and knows the path leading to the cessation of nutriment as it really is. What is knowledge of nutriment as it really is? It is this. There are four nutriments. The first nutriment is physical food, coarse or fine. The second nutriment is contact. The third nutriment is intention. And the fourth nutriment is consciousness. This is reckoned to be knowledge of nutriment as it really is. So this idea of nutriment is that which nourishes the physical food, nourishes the body, contact nourishes sense experience, intention nourishes all kind of actions, and consciousness is kind of the nourishment, the basis of all experience. I continue with the discourse. What is knowledge of the arising of nutriment as it really is? It is this. In dependence on craving, nutriment comes to be. This is reckoned to be knowledge of the arising of nutriment as it really is. What is knowledge of the cessation of nutriment as it really is? It is this. With the cessation of craving, nutriment also ceases. This is reckoned to be knowledge of the cessation of nutriment as it really is. What is knowledge of the path leading to the cessation of nutriment as it really is? It is this. The Noble Eightfold Path, from right view to right concentration, eight factors. This is reckoned to be knowledge of the path leading to the cessation of nutriment as it really is. Cessation of craving then obviously leads to going beyond physical food and contact, etc., only in the future, not right while one is alive. Bhikkhu Bodhi explains that in this discourse, each phenomena to be comprehended by right view is expounded in terms of its individual nature, its arising, its cessation, and the way leading to its cessation. So this is what I would like to conclude on today. We get this basic pattern in this exposition. We get an item. Here it is nutriment, and next week we will see there's a number of other items. Then that which causes it. Then the opposite, and then that which causes the opposite. And this is, in fact, the pattern of the Four Noble Truths. Dukkha. That which causes dukkha, the rising of dukkha, or craving. The opposite, the cessation of dukkha. And the fourth, the path to the cessation of dukkha. So you understand something, and its opposite. And in each case, you understand what causes it. To look at conditionality, this key aspect of the early Buddhist teachings. Always looking for, it's this, why it happened, how it happened, what is the condition? And there's a practical procedure there. From understanding something, you see its cause, and then you see there's an opposite. And you see the opposite causes. And there's a diagnostic scheme that underlies these Four Noble Truths, which has a parallel in Ayurveda and ancient Indian medicine. And next time I will be discussing why I think that this was already known at the Buddhist time, even though we do not have corroborating evidence in Ayurvedic texts. But now, for the time being, let us just come to this very basic flavor of the Four Noble Truths, where there is the diagnosis of the disease, there is dukkha. And this is what I find so fascinating about the Four Noble Truths, that according to tradition, the most central kind of teaching of early Buddhism is framed in medical terminology. Not some kind of theory, declaration the world is like this, like this. No, look, there's dukkha. Look, there's a pathogen. There's a virus. There's something responsible for that. That's craving, pointing to yourself. Whatever the others do, but there is a contributing factor on my side to my experience of dukkha, and that is craving. And then the vision that there is a state of health. There's a state of freedom from dukkha, nirvana. And there is an actual cure. There is a practical cure that you can take. There's a medicine you can take. You have to take it in such and such a way, the Eightfold Path. Yeah, that's it for today. We had a lot of discussion on meditation, which I quite enjoy, but still got a chance of getting rid of some of my my sutta stuff. And the most important things I would like you to take with you are these two aspects of the two discourses. The one, the power of recollecting our positive qualities. And the second one, to have just this basic feeling for this diagnostic scheme of the Four Noble Truths, which we will discuss in more detail next time. Okay, thank you very much, and see you in another week's time.